Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, tiny island nations produce an infinitesimal percentage of the greenhouse gases warming the planet, but at the moment they're suffering a significant amount of the damage, which is to say some of them are literally losing landmass as the sea rises around them. We'll spend this hour with Time Magazine's energy and environment correspondent Justin Warland. He's been covering the way these small countries, places like Jamaica, Fiji, and the Marshall Islands, are putting themselves at the forefront of the fight to keep warming below the level predicted to entirely submerge them. We'll talk about how that strategy is working and about why the UN Secretary General believes climate change is the most urgent crisis the international body has ever taken on. Our conversation starts after a short break. Even if you accept the scientific evidence that greenhouse gases are making the planet hotter with each passing year, the actual effects of that can be harder to see. Most residents of wealthy countries like the U.S. spend a lot of our time in artificially cooled and heated environments, and the biggest adjustment we've had to make is turning the thermostat down. Because of our geographic location, many of us have the luxury of imagining climate change as a problem for the future. Tiny island nations don't have that luxury. For them, climate change is an urgent, present tense issue, as places where human beings once lived become permanently submerged under rising seas. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The irony is that these small island societies scattered across the South Pacific, the Indian Ocean, and the Caribbean have relatively small economies, relatively small populations. The amount of carbon dioxide and methane they've put into the atmosphere is easily dwarfed by China, India, the EU, and the U.S. But they're bearing the brunt of the damage we have done to the climate. And as my guest has discovered, they are also stepping up to take the lead on the UN's global climate mitigation efforts. Justin Warland covers energy and the environment for Time magazine. He joins us now from NPR in Washington to talk about his reporting on this. Justin, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So you start your recent article on an island in Fiji, and I will let you tell us how to pronounce that. But it's a place that was abandoned 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. The town is called, or the village is called Vunidogoloa, and it's located on Fiji's second largest island. It's about it's 140 miles from the sort of main transit hub, and it was abandoned in 2014. They had had issues being along the coast for some time, but it got to the point where the flooding was such that they just decided that it didn't make sense to live there anymore. And so they moved about a mile up the hill.
So what's the location like today that was abandoned?
It's a ghost town. It's really eerie. Basically everything that was there before is still there. So you can see the empty abandoned homes. It has a, stench of rotting rodents, as I describe in the story. There's the town square has been overgrown by tropical forest. And then you can see sort of on the edge, of the town right by the coast, there's some sort of structures that they're no longer there because they've been, the water has risen such that's all that's left is a frame or a, sort of concrete type apparatuses. It's very eerie. It's abandoned.
And Fiji is expecting to relocate 40 more villages in the next few years. What is involved with that, and where can people go? Is there enough space for them to move elsewhere?
Right. Well, Fiji is actually one of the more fortunate countries in the South Pacific, if you can really call any place fortunate, in that it does have some higher lands and hills where they can go. So that's what happened to Vunidogoloa. They moved about a mile up the hill. And there are others that are sort of doing the same thing. That's what's going to happen to those 40 villages. Fiji is also sort of a hub for other countries in the region where, there's Kiribati is one of the countries that's very low-lying. Its entire landmass is just, at its highest point, a few feet above sea level. And they've actually purchased land in Fiji thinking that might be a place to go. But even still, 40 villages as a start is a lot, and the capital is right on the water, and there are questions about you can move a village of 100 people, but what happens when you move a city of 50,000 or so.
The Prime Minister of Fiji says he thinks about climate change literally every day. It's always on his agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things being on the ground there is you think about any issue, if you think about education and you think about, well, how do you get students to school if the road is flooded every day? How do you think about getting people to a hospital if the road is flooded? You know, it's the sort of issue that permeates everything and every sort of development issue that they're thinking about. And so you can see why it's really impossible to do anything if you don't think about how climate change is going to affect that. And it's really sort of an eerie warning, you know, for the future when you think about how climate change will permeate things that we're doing here, you know, and how eventually, when it gets so bad, it just becomes an issue that permeates into everything.
What does all this do to the GDP of a place like Fiji?
Yeah, I mean, it's really striking. They estimate that they will lose in the next few years about 5% of their GDP every year to flooding and storms. But sometimes it can be as high as 20%. In 2016, Hurricane Winston hit, and it knocked out equivalent to 20% of their GDP. And, you know, that's where we are now. That's expected to grow in the coming decades by 2050. And, you know, that's a big deal, especially for a country that's, you know, a developing country without many resources.
Yeah. So the tiny island nations of the world that are affected by climate change and are in danger of having, you know, part of their land masses literally submerged have started working together to press the rest of the world to make the changes necessary to hold climate change at bay. As you mentioned, like, these places don't have a lot of money. They don't have a lot of power. They're this, you know, you mentioned Kiribati. I think a lot of people don't necessarily even know what that is, where that is.
Right.
How have they managed to get everyone's attention?
It's really remarkable. You know, they've used the strength of their story, which is to say, you know, I went there and I told their story, but they've brought people in. You know, I talked to one of the vice presidents of the German parliament, who talked about her visit to Vunidogolo and to other places, you know, in the Indian Ocean as well as in the South Pacific, and how she came back and just, you know, really committed to wanting to do more for these countries. So when you see it firsthand, you want to do more, you want to help. And they've used that both by, I mean, Fiji held the 2017 climate talks, or rather they coordinated them, which entailed bringing some people in, climate diplomats from around the world, people who deal with these issues, to see firsthand what was going on. And that really reshapes the discussion. So it's really using the strength of their story, which I think in some ways can sound a little cheesy, but I think it's had a real effect.
So these countries began collaborating in 2015. What were those first meetings like? They don't necessarily agree on other issues, we should note.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you can sort of see when you're down there, and the meetings that I attended, you know, had all of these heads of state, and there's lots of tensions, there's lots of personality differences, and they don't necessarily get along in every way, but they unified around this. And so in 2015, they were looking ahead to the Paris talks, and they came up with this declaration of different things that they wanted to get out of the Paris talks, and the top of that list was keeping temperatures, or including a reference to keeping temperatures to 1.5 degrees of warming, because they see that as a safer level than 2 degrees, which had been the target for some time. And they brought in, and the story doesn't get into this as much, but they brought in partners from around the world. So it wasn't just the Pacific Islands, but the Marshall Islands was largely the leader, and they brought in all sorts of developing vulnerable countries. And they had a series of meetings that in the lead up to Paris, and eventually brought in others like the US and countries from the EU that they thought would be sympathetic to their concerns. And in fact, President Obama, when he went to Paris right before the start of the conference, the Paris Climate Conference in 2015, he met with President Xi, he met with Prime Minister Modi of India, he met with President Hollande of France, and he met with five leaders of island countries. And, you know, after the Paris Agreement, he said that was critical to his thinking. So they came in, that they built that momentum going in, and then were able to leverage that into different results in the actual discussions.
So you mentioned 1.5 degrees Celsius as the sort of upper limit that anybody feels is acceptable if we want these places to continue to survive. What happens if warming gets up to a full 2 degrees Celsius?
Yeah, I mean, I should say there's no safe level of warming. You know, warming. That's what scientists would say. We don't really know. You know, if things get to 1.5, we're still going to have a lot of dangerous sort of effects. But 2 degrees is the level where things could really be. The island countries, the island leaders, will say that that's a point where it's going to be very hard to survive. For one thing, the rising sea levels, you know, threaten to submerge them literally. And then also it's the storms. I mean, you can only survive a certain number of storms where you're eating away at your GDP, where you're constantly paying to rebuild. At some point, the calculus changes and it's no longer viable. It's no longer worth it. And you have to think about, you know, what else can we do? And I think that's 2 degrees is the level where they're saying, we just don't expect it can be worth it.
A number of these places also have developing economies. I have to imagine it's not good for investment when, you know, people who might put money into the country realize that it's really risky to put that money there when things that they spend on might be destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge it goes back to sort of the same, you know, we were talking about earlier, some of the challenges with education, with health, et cetera. It's one of those issues that permeates everything. I mean, it if you're looking to build, you want to build somewhere stable, and this is not the kind of place where that's the case. It raises the cost of capital. It makes investment riskier and then therefore more expensive. So they're working on ways to try to combat that. And trying to find ways to get investment that will help them combat those particular issues. But it's really challenging for precisely the reasons you say.
Is there a name of this block of small island nations that are sort of leading this effort?
Well, there's, it's funny because I avoid mentioning some of these names in the story because there are so many of them. But one of the longest standing ones is the Alliance of Small Island States, AOSIS as they're known. Hmm. But the one that sort of was the key one that was led by the Marshall Islands in Paris is the High Ambition Coalition. And the High Ambition Coalition, you know, brought together, it's not just small islands, it's climate vulnerable countries that were sort of leading it. And then they brought in basically everyone they could to join. It was a pivotal moment in Paris when the U.S. said, we're going to join this coalition. And then Brazil joined. And then all of a sudden we had this sort of huge group that represented, I don't remember the final number, but it was more than 100 countries. But it started with the leadership of the Marshall Islands and other vulnerable countries.
So you say it's a pivotal moment. It was a pivotal moment when the U.S. signed on to the climate agreement in Paris. I gather we pivoted again when President Trump pulled us out of our stated obligations.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's an interesting thing, which is that Trump has initiated the process of pulling us out. And so we do have until 2020. It's actually right around the time of the election when sort of the final action to pull us out has to happen. But it was definitely a pivotal change in direction for U.S. climate policy. As I noted, it's not necessarily the end of engagement. And in fact, you know, if you go, you know, last year I went to the climate negotiations in Poland, which were sort of an extension of what happened in Paris, and the U.S. is still there. They're working behind the scenes, and a lot of the same sort of behind-the-scenes negotiators are there. It's just that their position has changed. But, it would be, with a new president, a reversal wouldn't be necessarily that difficult.
And there are a lot of U.S. states and municipalities, right, that are continuing with the kinds of targets that would have existed had we officially stayed under the Paris Agreement.
Absolutely. And one of the things I find very interesting is around the world, I mean, talking to the Prime Minister of Fiji, you know, he's telling me, he says, well, I ask him about the U.S. and he says something diplomatic about the federal government, but Michael Bloomberg and the states and the cities, and they're very well aware of that in the Pacific and around the world. These efforts are have really permeated, and I would say they're also significant. I mean, a lot of energy policy in the U.S. is made at the state and local level, so those efforts matter.
Justin Moreland is with us. He covers energy and the environment for Time. We're talking about small island nations leading the push against climate change. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Time Magazine's energy and environment correspondent Justin Moreland. He's written recently for Time about small island nations coming together to really lead the UN's charge against climate change. So, Justin, we have UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who thinks that climate change may actually be the most urgent problem that the UN will deal with.
I have asked you here to sound the alarm. Climate change is a defining issue of our time, and we are at a defining moment. We face a direct existential threat. Climate change is moving faster than we are, and its speed has provoked a sonic boom SOS across our world. If we do not change course by 2020, we risk missing the point where we can avoid runaway climate change with disastrous consequences for people and all the natural systems that sustain us.
Justin, why does Guterres say the fight against climate change might make the UN relevant like no other issue has?
Yeah, I mean, climate change is an issue made for the multilateral system. It's an issue that no one country can really do all on its own. I mean, obviously, U.S. leadership, leadership from the EU and China, India is essential. But to get it all together, to get them all together in one room and get them to agree and to move forward as one really requires a global effort of coordination, global rules. And of course, the UN is an organization built for that. I mean, there's no other issue that is built quite the same way. And I think the other point that he made is that, and I thought it was very interesting to hear from him, is that while he deals with all of these other challenges, there's no other issue where everyone really agrees fundamentally on where we need to go. Hmm. Of course, the U.S. has sort of a different sort of top-level position, but ultimately, we all agree that climate change is bad and it needs to be stopped. And so the UN is in a perfect place to help coordinate that.
So how did Guterres become convinced that empowering these small island nations to take the lead on this was the way to go? Because it sounds like a risky move in some ways.
Yeah, I think it's in part because he's seen the dividends that their efforts have given in the past. And so, you know, Paris is one example. That was before his tenure. But last December, I referenced the Poland climate talks. He went to Poland to sort of help save them as they were coming. There were some challenges there, questions about whether everybody would be able to agree on one thing. And he came to those talks and gave an address and did some behind-the-scenes discussions. And at the same time, these same island countries were sort of doing the same thing that they'd done before. I think it was less pivotal than in Paris, but they were very influential in getting people back on track and reminding them of the stakes. And so he saw that firsthand, and I think that's in part probably fed into his plan to incorporate them at the heart of his current efforts.
He was actually in Fiji last month. What was that visit like?
Yeah, I mean, well, for him, he arrived. It was part of a four stop tour of the region, and so he arrived, and he basically all of the leaders of the region were there, and so he did bilaterals with all of them. He did sort of large multilateral group meetings, lots and lots of discussions. And then he also visited places that were actually being affected firsthand. And he told me some moving stories or moving experiences he had meeting with families who are sort of on the front lines of this. And he seemed very genuinely moved by it.
So another strategy he has is partnering these tiny island nations with larger, wealthier economies to take on particular aspects of the work of climate change policy. How has that played out?
Well, it's interesting. So they've sort of started this process, and we're going to see Later this month, these countries are all, everyone's coming together for a planning meeting for the summit that he's holding in the fall. And so I think it sort of remains to be seen exactly how it will play out. But I think the idea is basically it keeps the voice of these countries in the ear of keeps the voice of the vulnerable countries in the ear of the bigger economies to remind them to keep going in the right direction. But you know, I do think to be frank, it remains to be seen exactly how it plays out.
So what kind of pledges are we seeing from large economies around the world with regard to going carbon neutral or, completely sustainable energy?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I mean, these last few weeks, Germany, the UK, and Japan all in the last, last few weeks have all said that they're going to work towards net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And, you know, these are three very important countries, not just from their emissions, but also because they're hugely influential. And so there's sort of varying levels of commitment from each of them in terms of what that exactly looks like or how they've said they are going to do it. Or, you know, Japan said they're going to explore how to do it. And the UK is coming up with a legally binding approach to that. But net zero emissions, which is to say, either not emitting or sucking out more carbon than you emit by 2050 is a huge commitment, and it's in line with what helps get the world to that 1.5 degree goal.
The U.S. has shown less interest in something like this, but now there is growing pressure from our trading partners, right? Like, talk about what the EU is considering that might press the United States to finally tax carbon emissions.
Yeah, well, there's this interesting idea. It's called a border carbon adjustment that has gotten some traction in the EU. It's early stage, but it's an idea that's being discussed, and particularly with the sort of increased power of the Green Party, which did well in the last EU elections. There's this idea that they would tax products that don't have some sort of tax on their carbon emissions, right? So in the EU, they have a emissions trading system that companies essentially pay for what they emit. And so if you buy something, basically what they're saying is if they import something that doesn't have a similar sort of tax, they're going to charge, they could charge an adjustment on that, almost like a tariff to make that product less competitive. And that's something that would really force the hand, not just of the U.S., but of countries around the world. I would also say there's some folks here in the U.S. who are arguing for that, for a similar sort of approach, including a bunch of companies who sort of, I think, realize that this is a possible threat, as well as some conservatives, a small number, but some conservatives.
Yeah, I've been really interested that there are U.S. companies, including automakers, pushing back against lifting stricter emissions guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because the automaker story is fascinating because automakers originally went to the Trump administration and asked for an easing of the Obama-era rules, and then the Trump administration went much further than the automakers had wanted, and it's created this real uncertainty where they're going to have to deal with litigation, where they're going to have to deal with all these competitive issues that have made it just really complicated for them. I think that industry will get behind certain particular emissions reductions proposals if it meets their bottom line. And the truth is that the Trump administration has gone sort of so far out that a lot of their policies have either created this situation where American companies may not be as competitive on the global stage, or situations where they're subjected to a lot of uncertainty about what sort of regulations they might expect in 10 years, but also, you know, in the case of the automakers, in 2 years, because this litigation is really thrown everything into the air for them.
Is there any reason that they couldn't just adhere to what the standards were going to be before these changes were made? In other words, sort of hold themselves to higher standards?
Well, of course they could do that, but the issue is for automakers, the most profitable car to make, vehicle to make in the U.S. is an SUV. Mm-hmm. So if one company adheres to a stricter vehicle emission standard, then they're putting themselves at a competitive disadvantage. So it's absolutely something they could do, but I think it's much easier if the federal government is setting up rules of the road that they all have to adhere to and all will operate by.
I think people see a lot of similarities between the economies of a place like Germany or the UK and the United States. These are fully industrialized economies where people live, you know, middle class lifestyles for the most part. Is there any reason why these countries feel capable of going carbon neutral by a certain date and that the U.S. wouldn't be capable of doing so?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. The truth is that the technology is such that I think that we could, that most of these countries could do it with reasonably low costs. And I think there really isn't any reason to think that the U.S. couldn't do that. Of course, we have lots of natural resources. You're in Texas. You know, you have the Permian Basin in West Texas is a huge resource base for us. And so I think, you know, there's a question of, well, do we want to you know, to use our resources that provide jobs and provide income for American companies. I mean, I think there's a lot of questions along those lines that are less about whether it's actually technically feasible.
So in the lead up to the Paris agreements, bigger economies, wealthier countries were sort of haggling over accountability measures for one another while the damage kind of continued unabated to these small island nations. How did this coalition of island countries work to get past that roadblock?
Yeah, well, so it was really sort of a trade. These small countries went to the U.S. The U.S. was pushing for China and India to, well, I should say the U.S. was pushing for strong accountability measures across the board. But the real target of that was China and India because the U.S. was concerned that China and India would make nice promises, but then there perhaps wouldn't be follow through and that we wouldn't be able to tell whether they were actually following through. And the small islands basically said, well, we will endorse your push there if you endorse this 1.5 target. So it was a very simple trade. There were other things that these vulnerable countries gave up, namely this provision, some strong provisions around what's called loss and damage, which essentially provides some element of liability because, you know, from the developed countries that have emitted so much and caused the problem. So they gave that up. But it was basically a trade that happened behind the scenes.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Time Magazine's energy and environment correspondent Justin Warland. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. It's worth reminding people, Justin, that these very small countries with, in many cases, developing economies, they have contributed like an infinitesimal fraction of the greenhouse gases that have warmed the planet. But that has not stopped them from really remaking the way they use energy.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that you go to these countries that have limited resources, and so many problems, you know, to deal with those resources, but yet they say we are making commitments to reduce our own emissions, in many cases to eliminate our own emissions, to lead the world. You know, it's much easier to go to the U.S. and say you need to go 100% or you need to go net zero emissions if you're doing the same thing, and that's exactly what they're doing. And so it's remarkable to see that.
What kind of resources do they need for climate damage mitigation? Like what kind of infrastructure will they require in the next few years?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a whole array of different things. I mean, and there's a lot of debate about what exactly they should do. I mean, about whether they should, in certain places, whether they should build a seawall or whether they should use natural infrastructure, green infrastructure, as they call it, to protect certain areas, or whether they should move. So there's a vibrant debate, and part of that is in consultation with international institutions and expertise that's, you know, we have here or in Europe. But there's a debate about that. But the big thing is they need money for regardless of what it is that what direction they go down, they need funding. You know, ahead of Paris, the developed countries committed to basically helping finance to the tune of $100 billion a year, which is a lot of money. And that number is not has not been achieved. We're about two thirds of the way there, according to the OECD. But they need money to make whatever it is that they're doing happen.
There's also a human cost to the kind of displacement that you're talking about. When, you know, in Fiji alone, they're looking at moving 40 villages. Kiribati is looking at, you know, taking land in Fiji to you know, resettle people. Did you have a chance in your reporting to speak to just regular individuals about what they're looking at and how this will disrupt their lives?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really something because, you know, for people, you know, take Vunidogoloa, right? It's a village on the water. These are people who have spent, you know, their entire lives in this area. There's one car for the entire village. So their entire way of life and thinking is rooted in this place. And for them, you know, it doesn't sound like much, you know, moving a mile away, but you're talking about leaving your entire culture of waking up and going to the water and swimming and diving and fishing. And, you know, that changes everything completely. So there's this huge sort of cultural toll when you're so deeply rooted in a place. And it's hard, I think, to recognize, you know, for you know, people like me, and then, you know, where we live in a place where I've moved around this country, but it's not the same when you are so deeply rooted in a place and your culture and your way of life and thinking and living is so deeply tied to the place, this one place.
Some of the places on this list of tiny nations are heavily influenced by tourism, you know, Jamaica, the Bahamas. We've already talked a lot about Fiji. Is there concern that, like, the resorts will get preferential treatment over the places where real people live?
That's a good question. I haven't necessarily heard that, but those resorts have certain resources that villages don't necessarily have. But I actually haven't heard that concern. It's a good question.
My guest is Justin Moreland. He covers energy and the environment for Time magazine. We're talking about how small island nations that are threatened imminently with inundation as rising sea levels continue to be a problem, they are taking the lead on the fight against climate change. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Justin Moreland. He covers energy and the environment for Time magazine. He's been doing a lot of reporting lately on small island nations that are taking the lead in UN efforts at climate change mitigation. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Emily is on the line in Arlington, Texas. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. So I guess what my question would be is, I've been taught about global warming since I was in elementary school, and I'm about to turn 30 this next year. And other than greater efforts towards recycling, I'm wondering what is going to mobilize people? What do we need to do? What does Justin think is going to actually mobilize us to make the changes we need to take this more seriously as a society?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. It's a good question. I think I think it's important to talk about it and understand it, and then, you know, get that conversation going in a way that will inform the way people vote and engage on political issues. I mean, I think the biggest issue right now is, you know, the majority polls show that the majority of people, you know, believe in climate change. They understand the science of climate change at least a little bit, but that doesn't translate necessarily to voting or showing that that's something that they're really interested in. And I think that's the way, or really interested in and concerned about in a deep way. And I think that's the way that we really move the needle, right? People need to vote and talk about it in a way that gets politicians to change laws and rules and regulations. I think, you know, there are other things, of course, just thinking about the way that you consume energy and recycling is one thing, as you mentioned. You know, transportation is often the biggest part of people's carbon footprints, flying, driving long distances. But I really think the real way to make a difference is getting our political leaders to think about it.
You may have seen it. The New York Times had a piece this weekend about, you know, should we be flying if it's so bad for the climate? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think for me, it's challenging, right? Because, you know, I had to fly halfway around the world. But, you know, I think one thing, I think you should be selective about when you fly. I think the article, I believe, goes into a bit about the sort of debate about carbon offsets, which I think is something that, you know, each person can obviously come to their own decision about, but it's something that's worth thinking about. You know, when you buy an offset, you're paying to, I don't know, it depends on the thing, but you're paying to, say, plant trees somewhere else that will suck carbon out of the atmosphere or develop a renewable energy project somewhere. And I think that's an important thing to think about, especially if you're someone who needs to fly a lot, who needs to drive a lot.
It's occurred to me that carbon offsets, at least when it comes to flying, I think they would have much greater adoption if we had like an opt-out system. So in other words, if they were attached to the price of an airline ticket and you could choose not to spend that extra money. But I think if it were there already, a lot of people would say, yeah, I probably should do this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I also, it's one of those things I had a friend said to me recently, you know, airlines should sell carbon offsets. And I said, well, they do. it's just not necessarily very clearly advertised. But I think a lot of people would do it because the truth is it's not that expensive. Carbon offsets to Fiji were, you know, it was $50-something, which is not that much money when you think about the cost of the entire trip.
And otherwise, a trip like that would be literally tons of carbon emissions, right, per
person. It's a lot. It's a disturbing amount, and I don't have the figure offhand, but it's a huge impact that one flight has.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Our number 800-933-5372. Carol is calling us from McKinney, Texas. Hi, Carol.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I wondered if you had some thoughts about the Chinese building coal plants and that kind of thing as part of this road and belt, and they're going into Africa and helping to build more ports, more dams, this, that, and the other, that probably have some definite offset needed from them otherwise, that they're not really living up to the spirit or the letter maybe of what they supposedly are going to do and for their own country.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good, really good question. I think there's a long debate in the international climate discussions about what the responsibility of some of these developing countries like China should be. And the argument was for a long time, well, you all in the developed world have emitted so much, you've built your coal-fired power plants, we should be able to do that too to develop the same way. And that's shifted quite a bit. But the new sort of focus for countries like China is that their emissions are going to continue. Well, there's a debate about, you know, whether they've peaked, but it's less a question of whether they are going to stop absolutely, but how much can they slow the growth of things like coal-fired power plants. And I think there's a lot of reason to look and be comforted by what they do in terms of sort of global emissions, but there's also reasons to be skeptical. And I think that's one of the important elements of the Paris Agreement, is really setting up the structures so that we all have a transparent view of what's actually happening. So that was a sort of a little bit of a wonky answer, but I mean, I think you're absolutely right to be concerned, and I think there's evidence that that they have slowed/peaked their growth in emissions, and I think we just have to sort of see how that plays out. But absolutely, they need to have their feet held up to the fire to make sure that they're doing what they say.
Do you have a sense of why populist leaders in particular in many places around the globe seem to be particularly hostile to climate action?
I mean, I think there's an element of, if you're an inward-looking leader, an inward-looking country, you want to think that you can do things on your own, you know, that you want to step away from multilateral international institutions. And, you know, climate is a multilateral issue. It's an issue that needs to be dealt with across borders. And if you want to just say we, you know, well, you know, my country first, then it's much harder to think about how you forge those partnerships to address an issue that really needs a global response. And so that's my view of it. I'm sure there are lots of diverse views.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Nathan in Dallas. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
All right, so my question is, it was mentioned earlier in the program about how these small island nations are developing towards zero emission or net zero emissions, and how they can use that as kind of a, well, see, we did it, so the U.S. can too, or other larger nations can too. My question is, with these smaller countries being more developing economies, other than them saying, we did it, you can too, what bargaining chips do they really have to kind of put pressure on the larger economies that maybe aren't moving towards net zero emissions or zero emissions?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those, it goes back to them telling the strength of their story, which is to say, I think most people, you know, I mentioned the one of the vice presidents of the German parliament who went to Wunnedoggeloa and was just moved and just felt like this is the right thing to do. This is what we have to do. I think in terms of hard, concrete bargaining chips, you know, you're right to some degree that they don't necessarily have many. But it's a question of, you know, most people, most politicians don't want to look like they're on the wrong side of that. And so, you know, post-Paris, there was a lot of talk about what was called naming and shaming. So ways in which countries could be called out for not living up to their promises in a way that was embarrassing to them. And that shifted in large part because of the Trump administration and other things to sort of a more collaborative, less aggressive approach. But I still think that, you know, what they have is the ability to call out and say, look what you're doing. And that, to, I think, a lot of politicians and leaders is something that they don't want to be on the wrong side of.
So you mentioned earlier that Fiji hosted climate talks in 2017, and they gave participants of wealthier economies a tour of what climate was doing to their country. Can you talk about this kind of approach they had to dialogue and how it works?
Yeah, so they had what's called the Talanoa Dialogue, which was essentially a process where countries would get together, representatives of countries would get together, and they would have a conversation about where do we need to go and how do we get there and sort of what are our issues. And so it brought people together, and they held these in meetings across the world. It brought people together to learn about, you know, what's going on. So in some ways, you know, if you go to Fiji and you sort of see firsthand what's going on, you learn about what needs to be done. And I'm trying to come up with two good examples, but if you're from a place that isn't really making much commitment to clean energy and you go to a place that is, you can learn about how to do that. And so they really orchestrated these conversations and made it a part of the actual sort of required work of international climate diplomats, which then sort of permeates in that discussion and sort of the formal negotiations.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, back to the phones now. This time, Michael is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hey. I just wanted to give this guy congratulations for a very, very good answer he gave earlier. When the woman asked, what can we do? What can we do? There's an urgency to that, and it's such a good question. And I think it goes along with our KRA slogan, go public. If you can do something with an organization, if you can find a candidate you agree with, don't worry so much about your own recycling habits. That is infinitesimal. But go public, get with an organization, find other people you agree with. Don't do the fight alone. And I really wanted to celebrate your answer to it because it did emphasize that quite a lot. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Do you want to respond to any of that, Justin?
No, I think I appreciate the response. Thank you.
Does the UN have the financial resources it needs to get greenhouse gases fully under control and mitigate the worst effects of climate change?
Well, the UN can't do it alone. I mean, the UN is dependent on its member organizations, and I think that's a very good question, and I'm not really sure what the answer is to it. I mean, I think there's been a pullback from the U.S. in terms of UN funding. You know, I think that they would probably say that the leaders of the UN would probably say that they can rely on their members to do what they need to do. But I mean, I think it's a good open question that I wouldn't quite know what the right answer is.
What would it take for a future president to recommit the United States to the pledge we originally made in the Paris Agreement?
Well, I guess there's two questions there. One is about being a part of the Paris Agreement formally, and that really depends on whether President Trump and the administration goes through with his stated intention of pulling the U.S. out, which, as I mentioned, is right around the time of the election. And that, if he goes through with it, that really complicates things. The truth is, though, with regard to our overall commitment, you know, we're moving in that direction. I think there's lots of different policies that could be implemented that could bring down our emissions, along with the 26 to 28% reduction that the Obama administration committed to. It's really sort of an open question as to how we can do that. I mean, and you see sort of more conservative approaches that are under discussion related to a carbon tax, and you see, you know, Green New Deal type approaches that are on discussion on the other side of the spectrum. And you know, there's lots of different ways you could mix and match and keep us, keep the U.S. in line with the Paris Pledge.
So the United States has island territories. It has a great deal of mainland coastline. Are you seeing these parts of the country push in a different way for climate reforms than people who may not be as imminently familiar with the ways that climate change is causing sea level rise?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's really a bunch of different kind of strange examples. Like Mark Sanford is a Republican from South Carolina. He lost his reelection, but he, you know, came out and started talking about how climate change is real and we need to do something. And, you know, he's from, coastal South Carolina, in a place where they've experienced frequent flooding. Down in South Florida, Carlos Curbelo was a Republican who also lost re-election, but he, you know, he led an initiative to get a carbon tax in the House, and he represents, you know, South Florida, where they experience flooding all the time. So there is definitely sort of a different perspective on the ground if you go to these places in the U.S.
Justin Moreland covers energy and the environment for Time Magazine. Justin, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app, and feel free to leave us a review. Let us know how we're doing. If you want to find out about upcoming shows, check our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.